Welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast, where modern portfolio theory can suck it. A student of the school of Graham and Doddsville and a clergy member of the Church of Warren Buffett, here's your host, Eric Schlein.
We're live, so welcome to the Intelligent Investing Podcast. This is Eric Schlein. Brian, welcome back to the show.
What's going on, man? Eric. Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me back on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, for sure. I'm just going to change my microphone settings because I'm a little bit more on monitor and less on you. Why don't you say something again? Just get a little closer in your mic.
Good morning.
All right, perfect. Well, good morning back. How have things been going?
Good. Halloween's coming up, and my kids are excited.
Nice. You guys dressing up for anything?
My 5-year-old guess what she wants to be. My 5-year-old girl.
A princess?
Well, that's the common answer, right?
Like a Disney princess or something like that? Yeah, Tinkerbell?
Do you know what she wants to be?
Well, clearly I don't.
She wants to be a fly.
I'm sorry, what?
She wants to be a black fly.
A black fly.
And cool. We got her a black fly costume.
I didn't know they made those.
Well, I didn't know either.
Interesting. Huh. Well, hey, whatever makes you happy, right?
Every 5-year-old dreams to be a black fly.
To be a black fly. I can't say I ever had. I had some cool costumes, though, growing up. I used to do these over-the-top masks that I'd have my mom buy me. And Jesus, she actually bought them for me some of the time, which was awesome. But yeah. And I grew up in Florida, so it was like I couldn't even wear them the whole night because it'd be like, 85 degrees with like 90% humidity wearing this like gigantic like stage costume mask on me thinking I was all cool.
Where were you in Florida? Where about?
I grew up in Miami.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Before I moved to New York. I've been all over.
Miami, that's quite the scene.
Yeah, well, I wasn't part of that scene at like 8 years old. It was, me at the club at 8.
Yeah.
it's a whole different Miami once you're a little bit older.
Yes.
I couldn't ever get used to that humidity, though, I gotta say.
Well, I remember being there and people would just walk around looking for a bank or a store just for the AC.
Yeah, that's like no one walks around the streets. When my parents moved from Baltimore down to Florida, one of the first things I noticed was I said, where are all the people? Because no one was walking around outside.
Yeah. It's an empties out in the summer too.
I like being around people. So anyway, we're going to talk about Brookfield today. It was like a month ago now. September. Yeah, about a month ago when we had Brookfield Investor Day. So. This has been a few weeks in the making now to do this podcast, which I'm excited about.
Yeah, we've been trying to do this for a long time now. So future listeners, it's you were away, then I was away, then all that stuff. So finally, we're doing this.
Yeah, we're finally here. So let's start with do you have the Brookfield presentations up on your computer? I think it's good that we just have these slides up.
Yes, they have a bunch. You like the parent?
Yeah, so I have the parent company up, Brookfield Business Partners. I have Brookfield Infrastructure Partners, even though I don't have much to say about that. And then I also have Brookfield Property Partners up, which I don't have much to say. There's renewables, but I didn't really feel like there was much to say about renewables other than it's going better than expected from a macro perspective. That's like the only comment I had about renewables.
Right. Well, full disclosure, it's the only presentation that I didn't attend.
Oh, yeah. It was okay. It was interesting.
I got nothing against Brookfield Renewables.
No, I think, I don't either.
But, if you look at the setup of the day, it's presentations all day, which is it's good, but
dude, that was a long day, man. I'm amazed we both made it through. I was so tired. I was on just a few hours of sleep. Remember how tired I was at the end? I was like, I need to go, man.
Yeah, no, it's a long day. It was a long day. But I'm glad I went down. New York City, I haven't been there in a while, and it's nice what they did in that area. The Lower Manhattan, you know, Brookfield has that building, Brookfield Place. But I think it was
a lot of people don't know about, like, even like my dad, right, who's like very from New York, works in New York. Yeah. He didn't even know about Brookfield Place because it's so far down.
Well, it's an extension of their personality. Like, they're not flashy, and yeah, it's right next to the new the Freedom Tower, and I think that whole area used to be called World Financial Center. You're probably more familiar with that place.
Yeah, that was all of that. But it's yeah, for those listening who've never been there and go to New York, it's worth checking out. It's pretty cool. There's a lot of like interesting shops inside and food, and
it's a nice place.
It's really nice inside, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah, I recommend
it. Yeah, if you look online, you can find photos like of the inside, and it's like super beautiful inside.
They have an Instagram account.
Do they really?
The Brookfield Place has an Instagram account. Yeah.
Oh, rad! Cool.
So there we go.
Yeah. So let's just jump into it, huh?
Yep. Let's do this.
So let's start with the parent company, Brookfield Asset Management. We don't need to go into what the company does and all that. I think everyone knows who listens to the show the story. And if you don't, we have like two or three other episodes where we talk about Brookfield. So if you go into ericschlein.com/podcast, you can find previous episodes where we talk about Brookfield quite extensively. So I don't want to just rehash what we've already talked about before.
Yeah. Well, since you bring that, we talked about a year ago, just over a year ago.
Yes. Yes.
And I think you, I don't know if it's a tweet or a Facebook, you mentioned the return, and your listener, if they've been listening, they've made a very good return.
They made a damn good return.
Since that first talk, yeah, at least 30-35%, if I recall, but you know, without the dividends, obviously. But,
yeah, well, there isn't much of a dividend with Brookfield.
No, you need the partnerships for that. But, let's jump to the presentations. Bruce, you know, he comes across as a very humble man, very unassuming, down to earth, and basically starts with, you know, he talks about, I mean, I'm like, the key here is the four takeaways, right? He's like, here's what I'm going to talk about, and he brings up his four things that you probably should, he wants to talk about, and he talks about global interest rates, you know, being in the range of -2 to 2%, as in -2, you know, negative interest rates. And he believed that's the backdrop for the next couple of years. How he plays that, you know, it's just the way, because they use debt to buy companies, all kind of stuff. This, you know, and that allows them to refinance at a really, really cheap costs. I think he mentioned an example, like in Germany, where they got financing for 0.7 for 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, it was something like that. All right, we're back. Had a little technical difficulty there. Wanted to do a video, but wasn't prepared for that today. So, but I do want to do some of these on YouTube. I think it would be cool to put some of these on YouTube, because I know some of the listeners have been like, oh, why don't you guys have stuff like on YouTube? And I do have some stuff, but I think it'd be cool to have like video and compile some clips, so people who don't want to listen to a whole 2-hour thing can have certain, you know, talking points that they can hear on YouTube. So that'll be something we're going to do in the short term future.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah. So we were talking about the four takeaways, Brian, and right, you were talking about how they've been able to get, say, like loans, you know, at super, super low, super low interest rates, that they can borrow money at super low interest rates.
Well, yeah, that's one of the consequences. You know, we were just mentioning the example in Germany where they got a super good rate for a long period of time.
Right.
And I think one of the things he was mentioning too, for every percentage point, now you might have to correct me on this, before every percentage point lower, like every time the lower interest rate goes on a percentage point, it brings, it potentially could increase the stock by $20. Is that what he was saying?
I think So I'd have to look at the exact number. I don't remember. Yeah, so for every 100 basis point cap rate reduction, it's $20 additional in Brookfield value per share.
Now, I had a – I wish I would have asked him that question. It only came in my mind after. Does that mean every time the interest rate goes up 1%, we should shave $20 off?
It was to an extent because I know they do hedge interest rates somewhat to the upside.
Right. Well, basically, that setting is obviously positive for a company like Brookfield. Now, where they invest in real assets with fixed contracts and all that stuff. And the second point where, which I found very interesting, is basically alternatives are no longer alternatives. And what it means like that, alternative as an asset class, institutions would allocate money to, equity, fixed income, and something called alternatives. Now they realize it cannot be longer alternatives. We have to do this. And basically he's predicting that, or they're assuming, that the allocation to alternatives is going to grow at a much faster rate. And then obviously he goes on to explain, the percentage point and how fast he accelerates. And his third takeaway, which again is linked to the second one, is these funds going to get bigger? And he was talking about the next series of fund could be $100 billion, which is massive. And my takeaway from that takeaway, basically he's saying, the active, the amount of money that active manager manage, it's a hard time. People are moving to passive, right? Indexing, ETF, that kind of stuff.
But yeah, the last episode we did was on that.
Right. So it's getting very difficult for, an asset manager to raise money. But these guys, you got about, the top 5 to top 10 guys. What's happening is like a funnel. All the money, because there's a lot of money on the sideline. There's a lot of dry powder. And all that money is going to these guys. So they're seeing an acceleration of assets under management. So much of it, they can scale it. And a company like Brookfield and the other guys in the field like Blackstone, KKR, Apollo, the bigger they are, it's one of these things where the bigger they are, the more they can attract money because of the size of the deals, and only a few people can do what they do. So that, that's good for them. And the last takeaway is the Oaktree acquisition, which with Howard Marks, basically what they were saying is they've been trying to build a credit platform to prepare themselves for the next downturn, like a credit distressed asset, that kind of stuff. And this is a game of scale. So the bigger you are, like I was saying, the better position you are in. And by acquiring Oaktree and Howard Marks, which is, kind of like the king of distressed assets, doesn't get any better than this. So that was his 4 points, from his introduction presentation.
Yeah.
Did you how did you like the Howard Mark fireside chat?
Yeah, I mean it was okay. The takeaway that I got from it was we've never been in an interest rate environment like this. It's mm-hmm. hard to know what that means. There's nothing to model on. If interest rates stay this low, then stocks are potentially incredibly cheap. So don't be overly cautious and miss opportunity, but then don't be overly aggressive and screw yourself over if interest rates go up. Therefore, who the hell knows? That was my impression.
I think you're spot on. I totally agree.
Why I like Brookfield is when Bruce Flatt is predicting this, it's not a guarantee, obviously. No one's saying it's a guarantee. If interest rates go to 4%, Brookfield's still totally okay and still going to be a good rate of return over time. So it's not like this depends on low interest rates. It's just there's additional value that gets created in the short term if interest rates stay low. Look, if interest rates are at 4% and Brookfield is still having all these opportunities because we're still in the early innings of this massive infrastructure boom, privatization of infrastructure, you know, they're still going to do really well. So it's not, it's, this isn't just like some macro bet where you have to be totally right on what happens. I think you can generally say with pretty high confidence that these alternative assets are going to get larger over time. There's more privatization of infrastructure over time. And there's only a few companies that are in a position to take advantage of the majority of the capital. So there's already a few winners that are going to come out of this. And Brookfield is going to be one of them. I don't think that's too much of a stretch to say.
No, the backdrop is there for them to succeed, obviously.
And look, we're talking about an additional $20 in Brookfield value. You know, if you think the plan value is $150 over the next 5 years, $20 isn't, you know, it's a lot, but it's not gonna make or break the investment.
Right. To go back to what Mark's.
Yeah.
I guess what I retained from
it. Do you make your H's silent? Is that a Canadian thing or a French? Is that a French thing?
The H.
Yeah, you're like
out. Yeah, okay. It's a French thing.
It's a French thing.
We don't pronounce the H in French, and it's a silent H. So sometimes when I speak English, I would carry that over, which is sorry for the listeners out there, but
Howard Marks.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I can keep picking on you. It's just really funny.
Howard Marks.
There you go. Okay, so you actually can say it. So
yeah,
it's not like what is it with what language is it where they can't pronounce the L's?
Korean.
Yeah. Did you ever see Team America?
The South Park guys,
yeah.
Right?
Do you remember the song "Lonely" with Kim Jong Un?
Yeah,
he goes,
"I'm so
lonely."
Long time ago. Yeah, I remember that.
Oh my god, so funny. Anyway, go ahead. Just made me think of that.
Well, just to get back to Howard Marks.
Yeah. Somehow we went from Howard Marks to Kim Jong. Kim Jong-il. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if he'd like to be in the same sentence. I don't think he...
Tough shit, he was.
Yeah.
I think he'll survive. Okay.
You meet guys like him, and I think one of the purpose is sometimes you're looking for answers, right? You're expecting answers. Okay, he's the guy. He's the main guy. He's one of the great investor. Maybe he can clarify what is going on. And my impression out of this, I was more confused. Because he didn't know. I mean, he basically say the short answer is, well, I don't know what's going on. And if he doesn't know what's going on, well, you know, guys like me or any other investors out there that are looking for guidance, this answer does not provide confidence.
No, but this is why I like – so it does provide confidence for me, but in a different way, right? So there's some ways that I model this internally where I think to myself, okay – no one knows what the hell's going on, right? So there's a lot more uncertainty in the market. Because there's more uncertainty, there's more opportunity to do good deals. Just because people don't, you know, you could say they undervalue uncertainty.
Right.
So the markets hate uncertainty. Right. So if you have total certainty, you're going to pay up for that certainty. With uncertainty, it's the opposite. If you can have a scenario where kind of regardless of what happens, you'll do fine and there's uncertainty, it's kind of amazing. So I think Brookfield's in that position, right, where they don't have to know what's going to happen to take on good deals. You know, if they can invest in an infrastructure project and get these almost utility-like economics, mm-hmm. Bought with higher returns, right?
Yeah.
Now, if interest rates go up, well, these these utilities are still going to cash flow. You can then reinvest those assets into higher cap rate assets going forward, and also take advantage of companies that were over-levered and now going to have to pay higher interest rate, you know, interest expenses, and maybe not be able to make it. So if interest rates go up or we hit a recession, then Brookfield can take advantage of the things that happen with that, right? And then, you know, they have Howard Marks and they can invest in maybe some distressed debt and if we have a situation like that. So there's so many levers and things that can happen. But if you just kind of model it out very big picture, Brookfield can use certain levers depending on what happens and still do really well.
Right. Well, do you know what's great about these guys is, you know, if you're invested in their funds, you can't get out.
Yeah.
So the fee is going to keep coming in. You can't get out because you're invested, you know, it's a close for like 10 years or something. So they can, you know, weather a 2 to 3 year, let's say, downturn. And I asked him, Bruce, I asked him a question. You know, what keeps you up at night? You know, what do you worry about? And obviously, you know, the backdrop of the global economy, all that stuff. But he said, look, we're just going to focus on our business. We're just going to focus on what we do. And, you know, we're going to focus on the business and prepare for the next downturn. And it's going to come. It's going to come one day. And basically, it's to be ready for it. And, you know, he said something like great companies excel during tough time. And basically, it's to position themselves for that next downturn, that next recession. And the acquisition of Oaktree and Howard Marks obviously positioned them to do that. And, you know, just to say one more thing about Howard Marks, it's you know, he's very confusing in his answers because when asked, like, what are you doing, all that stuff, we say, yeah, you have to be cautious. You have to be careful. But then in the next sentence, he'll say something like, I'm fully invested and I continue investing, but I'm more cautious than usual. You know, there's a little bit of a double speak there. And he say you shouldn't be in cash because you might miss something, but you have to be, you know, his standard line, like cautiously optimistic or something like that.
Well, so, you know, I was talking about in the last episode that I did earlier this week, that we're in a really interesting time in the market where there's a lot of assets that seem very overpriced, but then there's a whole other spectrum of assets that don't seem very overpriced at all and actually seem really, really cheap. And there's like a very wide disconnect between assets that look undervalued and assets that look overvalued in the market. There's a different pocket. So even though I think the markets generally look kind of on the expensive side, maybe, right? There's still a lot of opportunity that I see.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, like you said, I should probably listen to your last podcast, but this stock market you're talking about, either a stock is trading 100 times PE or 10 times PE.
Right. And in Brookfield's situation, you know, their deal flow is incredible.
Oh, they're not stopping.
Right. So they're not having a hard time finding value.
No. That's what they're good at. They find distressed assets, you know, companies with issues. I mean, just an example, in their Brookfield, the private equity partners,
the
right?
Business partners,
Business partner, thank you. The business partner one, they go to one of the example with their the nuclear power company, Westinghouse.
Yeah, well, let's save that for a little bit later because there's a lot I want to say about that.
Right.
So I don't want to jump too far ahead.
Okay.
Let's stick with the asset management company first.
Right. But, well, no, if people aren't interested, you know, there's a 92-slide presentation on the website. The whole thing.
Well, you know, one of the things you were saying, too, around these larger firms taking most of the capital. So on slide 24, let's use slide numbers too. So if any of the listeners want to follow along. So on slide 24, Bruce Flatt talks about, he says, according to a recent survey, 25% of all capital raised was by the top 10 largest asset managers, which is incredible because there's a lot of assets that are being raised. A lot of assets.
Yeah, but it always goes to the top people.
Yeah.
And I would like to break down that 25%.
Okay.
To the top five. Like, I don't have the data, but it'd be interesting to see because I don't think it's evenly. I don't think the top 10 gets 2.5% each, right? I think.
I don't know. Yeah, that'd be interesting.
You know, maybe the top five gets, maybe more than half of it, probably. Mm-hmm. But it'd be interesting to see that study. But no, it confirmed what he was saying, basically.
Yeah, and if you look at their perpetual capital commitments, in 2018 it was $2 billion. 2019 it goes to $6 billion. And their long-term target is $60 billion. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah. Well, he made a comment. he made a comment that the next 10 years are going to be better than the last 10.
Well, I've been saying that for years now.
Because of their size or scale?
Yeah, it's no different than any of these companies that take advantage of these, you know, S curves and adoption cycles, right? It's no different than this, you know, where you could look at Brookfield, is they're riding this large wave of private infrastructure, right? And they're also riding another, you could say, trend of alternative assets and asset management companies, right? So you could say there's these two trends they're taking advantage of. Okay, so let's say they capture somewhat of a tiny sliver or even a large sliver of that growth. Well, they're in a better position now to take advantage of that growth than they were 10 years ago. So the growth continues to happen. They're in a much better competitive position, right? There's the asset management's gonna be a larger percentage of their intrinsic value going forward. They have more experience, they have more scale. The growth isn't slowing down, so therefore they're gonna take a larger percentage of that growth, meaning the intrinsic value will, I would say, more than 50% chance the intrinsic value has a higher annualized rate of return over the next 10 years than it did over the past 10 years. That's always been my thinking.
No, I agree.
That's how I would sum it up. That's the logic to me.
I agree. And these institutions that has to invest money for, you know, pensions, insurance company, all that stuff.
Right. And yeah. As that becomes more of a mainstream thing to do, more people will do it. And then because more people do it, more people will do it. And it kind of compounds on itself.
But these guys, they need returns, right? Because they have long-term liabilities.
Mm-hmm,
and
of course.
Part of the attraction to dealing with a company like Brookfield is that, for example, an institution wants to manage, let's say, they're not going to buy a toll road and manage it.
I think this is pretty self-explanatory, right? They're not going to buy their own asset. They're going to go buy an investment of a fund that can do it for them.
Right.
And get a better return while not taking any kind of crazy excess risk.
Yeah, they don't want to deal with that. So, you know, they in a way subcontracted instead of going for a 7-10% return and taking the risk. Maybe they'll be happy with a 4 or 5, but they don't have that. You know, they're not running it. They don't have greenfield project or that kind of stuff. So,
yep.
For them, it's kind of like an asset light way of meeting their future liabilities.
Yeah,
I think I saw somewhere in the representation. You know, with the acquisition of Oaktree, it closed like two, three days after the investor day. Their institutional investor, like the number of institutional clients went from 700 to 1,800 plus.
Yeah, nope. It went up a lot.
Yeah, so, you know, they more than double the amount of clients available.
And then there's opportunity to cross-sell products when you do that as well.
Well, that's the thing, right? That's the thing. They can make tailor-made products for these guys. Anybody. Yep. You know, you want special opportunities, we got it. Spreadsheet managed account, we got it. You know, distress asset, we got it. What do you need? Real estate, we got it. Europe, Asia, we got it. Whatever.
There's not many firms that have that kind of flexibility as well.
No, and there's a high barrier to entry. You can't, me and you or anybody else, we can't do this tomorrow morning.
No, so by the way, like, this conversation is also exactly why I have such a large investment in Brookfield. I mean, for some of the accounts I manage, it's 20 to 25% of their assets. And I've been invested in Brookfield since 2014. The thing that I love, right, is like, look how long we've been talking about Brookfield, and we just keep talking about their competitive advantage and their moat. And this is how many levers they have that make them hard to compete with in this business.
Right. Right. And, you know, let's say tomorrow morning I raise $100 billion.
Yeah, we keep going. Yeah.
You know, go ahead. Just let's go in the dream field. I raise $100 billion, mm-hmm. and, you know, Brian Lang is going to start, you know, an alternative management, alternative fund, you know, platform, whatever. I don't have a track record. Nobody, even if I have all the money, I won't be able to do what they're doing. I don't have the people. I don't have the size. I don't have the global platform. I'm not flexible. I don't have the operating expertise, which, you know, somebody will look at. That would probably stop my fundraising right there.
Yeah, you'll have a hard time hiring people.
Yep. And, you know, like you say, they have a giant moat, and that moat is getting bigger and bigger.
Also, let's say you even hire the same people, which you're not going to, but let's just say in some weird fantasy world, you're able to hire people of the same caliber. Okay, well, you don't have the scale.
Yeah.
You can't take advantage of certain opportunities that Brookfield can.
You know, we're not going to open offices
with 100 million, 30, 40 you're not countries. Even close.
Yeah, it's hard to do. It's hard to do. Do you think, I'm just going out there right now, but do you think it's guys like Brookfield and Blackstone that are a real competitor to Berkshire for when a company needs money?
No, because there's a lot of there's companies that say Berkshire is investing and that Brookfield may not be interested in, and vice versa.
Hmm.
Like, Berkshire isn't going in to do, say, what Brookfield Business Partners is doing with Westinghouse. I mean, they've done a little bit with 3G, but what 3G does compared to, say, what Dennis Churcott was talking about at Brookfield Business Partners. I mean, 3G are amateurs compared to some of the stuff that they're doing with Brookfield Business Partners.
Hmm. That would have been a good YouTube clip.
Yeah, it would. it's funny though, right? Because I'll get into this a little bit later. I've been working on a project that I've not been very public about. I thought someone would steal the idea. But I realized no one's going to steal this idea because no one's even interested. I'll talk about it on the podcast later. I'll probably one person at most find it interesting. That's what kind of competitive advantage doing some of that work is. But we'll get into that a little bit later. But it's also one of the things I think is really special about Brookfield Business Partners. They're one of the only companies I've ever come across that are creating all this excess value because no one else is doing it. No, really, no one else is doing it. Like, 99% of the people are not doing it. Most people do the 3G route of cost cutting and looking to make things more efficient, and it's more tangible for people.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Brookfield Asset Management.
Sure. What area? I mean, we touch a lot of things.
Yeah. I'm just looking at their slide presentation to see what else. So they're talking about new investments currently being driven by four themes. That's on slide 34. So they're talking about things like special situations in North America. So like Forest City and Westinghouse. The interest rate inversion, particularly in Europe, And then they talked about I'm just going to be upfront. I don't know much about this third one, but Bruce Flatt said it was worth learning about if you're interested. Banking stress in India, that there's a lot of
right.
It's hard to get hard to get loans. There's lots of opportunity in India where you can be a capital provider when banks can't. And then the fourth thing is the reorganization of balance sheets in China. So you can start taking advantage of some of the privatization of some of these assets in China as well, and take advantage of the next 20, 30 years of growth in that country as well. At a good price.
It's interesting that he talks about India and China. I mean, I know the whole banking stress in India slide. I mean, tell me it came out of the blue, but I did read something about it. They have this old shadow banking industry where basically the issues are, quickly is that the banks have invested in these developers, and then, if they can't pay the loan and the developer does bad, you have this two, three things, negative things that could hit the system, and they don't know how much money is in these loans. But basically, that tells me he's saying it's one area they're looking at. And, China, every time you hear about China these days, it's all negative. And they just bought a giant office building for over $1 billion. I don't remember the numbers, but they made a big move over there. But I think India, obviously, if you look at the next 10, 15, 20 years, you take a macro focus, you have over 1 billion people there just on the consumer side of things. You have 1 billion people in this, it's a capitalist country. It's the largest democracy in the world. And these guys all want, a better life. They all want to go to middle class. And it's going to be an interesting place. And, China and India it's hard to invest there. So, if you want exposure, especially to India, I don't know many, Fairfax has a fund, which obviously is not the topic of this discussion, but there's only a few players right now where we are in North America, and these guys, they're down there, Brookfield's down there, and it's one of these things to look at. But that'd be an interesting topic to talk about, India, in one of your future podcasts.
Yeah, we have there's a guy who's been on the show before. His name is Gobinath. He's looking to start an India fund right now. He's a good investor, and he's Indian. I think he'll be successful. But let's say he is successful, right? He's not going to be doing providing capital to companies that are underbanked or they need a loan and they can't get a loan. That's not what he's going to be doing. He's just going to invest in tiny little obscure small caps in India and probably make good money. So they really do have a niche.
It is, and I think the stock market in India is very, very expensive too.
Yeah,
I don't have the numbers, but
generally, so I mean, my impression of India just is there's generally expensive, and there's certain pockets, especially amongst small caps, where you can find some value.
It's worth studying. It's definitely worth studying.
I mean, not to me, because I can't invest in India, but but anyway, but that's probably why it's worth studying, because people like me can't invest in India, right? Seriously, if you have an Indian background and you have residency or you're part Indian or whatever, you can go to India, know the language, know the culture. You have such a competitive advantage to invest in India. It's not even funny. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
Hey, look, if you don't live in some rural part of China and you live in the United States, you have a competitive advantage to invest in markets too, right? So there's always trade-offs to everything. And I'm pretty freaking lucky that I was born in the time period I was in the United States.
Boots on the ground, man. Boots on the ground.
Yeah.
Especially in these countries.
So on slide 40, they say a little bit of what we already said, where they say, we summarize the franchise is broader and deeper than ever before. The backdrop for client capital is strong and increasing, and despite lots of capital in the world, few people have the skills to transact in areas that we do. If we execute, the next 10 years are set up to be better than the last 10. So it's
there we go.
I'm glad they said that, because it's like one of those things I've always been thinking, but
they believe it. They believe it. They're very confident. They were very confident in their presentation.
Yeah, they said as long as we deliver, which is an if.
I think when I asked him, my follow-up question was something along, hey, this presentation that Brian put together, the CFO here, how reliable are they, the numbers? Because they do a lot of assumptions and predictions. And, you know, I'm like, well, what if there's a recession, a downturn? Are these numbers reliable? And he said, yeah, mostly. So we've been doing this for 30 years. If you go back and you can look at our numbers, it's public, it's available. We've been pretty, pretty accurate. He said it's less the we're going to get the numbers right. And it's more, this is the direction we're going in. And basically saying if we hit a recession, basically what he's saying is that if you go back to our track record when there was a recession, we hit our numbers, there's like a delay, it's like a 2 years delay. So basically whatever they say, we'll hit, instead of year five, we'll hit these numbers in year seven.
Yeah, and then you're also going to have more of a competitive advantage at year seven because some of the other weaker players have either left the market or you've been able to buy assets on the cheap. So it extends the growth a bit more, but when the growth happens, it's even higher.
Right. Well, they're buying on the cheap. So yeah, great exactly. Companies, it goes back to great companies excel during tough times. So it puts they're really putting their business at work Our mark, if they ever hit that recession. And it's a question of time. It's not when's the next one. It's a question of when is it and, how the degree, the impact,
Sure. So that being said, though, one of the things that has caught my eye, right? So on slide 45, they just talked about the growth in capital, right? And it's the company's growth is amazing. And this is getting back to before, where there's parts of the market that are expensive, parts of the market that are really, really cheap. I mean, right. Where the hell can you buy a business? So, if we look back to last year, right, here I am, I'm paying 9x FFO for Brookfield Asset Management. I'm buying more in like the low 40s. I think my cost basis last year was like 41 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So imagine buying a company at 9x earnings, but they're growing at like double digit rates of return, and they're a great company and a leader in their industry. Where else do you find that?
Trading
at a discount to the sum of the parts, right? They're saying, oh, we're worth about 66, while the stock at that time was trading at 42.
Right. No, the charts are here. They're growing at 20-25%, like the capital, fee-bearing capital, 27% for last year. And this is not some Silicon Valley,
The way they do it, and we've gone through this in other episodes, but they always assign a multiple of 20x to their fee-related earnings. And then 10x to net target carried interest.
Yeah, they break it down for us. They break it down. I know they break it down. I don't know if it's in this slide somewhere, but they do. They're very transparent. If somebody wants to research it, they have like supplement disclosure and all that stuff. And they really, really break down. If anybody's interested, they really break down every fund. The assets, the returns, where the money is invested, their assumptions. So they do a really good job, helping investors making sense of this giant company. But do you want to move along?
Yeah, sure. So they basically said at the investor day. If you add the invested capital plus the asset manager, using those multiples, you would get a per share price of $68, a little over $68, which at the time was a 22% discount to, the stock was trading at 22% discount to that.
Oh, that's a nice margin of safety.
Yeah.
That's a nice margin of safety. And that's with today's number, right? If they hit the targets, it's a bargain.
Yeah, so they actually draw it out where they say, if BAM would generate over $2 billion of cash, they distribute 30% to shareholders. And you can look at all this in the slides, and they just show how they're going to grow over time and in their model and what things look like if they can execute.
Yeah. I think the numbers that hit me I don't know if it's in this slide somewhere, but it's their growth, their cash growth over the next couple of years. I don't know if it's in this presentation. I don't have it in front of me, but they're talking about they're going to have a 40 to 50 billion in cash in the next 5 years that's just free cash.
Yeah, it's like, what's their market cap right now?
That's the thing, right? Yep. So 9% of their market cap.
Yep.
Cash.
They're going to make their entire market cap back in cash.
And I feel that goes unnoticed. Like,
No one talks about that.
It's
like they literally just told you they're going to make their entire market cap back in cash over the next however many years.
I think it's 5.
Sure, it's not 10.
Let's say they make $5 million a year. Yeah, that'd be 10 years. You're right.
Yeah. Okay.
Because they're making 2.5 now. Right. So the next 10 years.
But my point is that even 10 years, if they make their entire market cap back in cash, that's still a pretty amazing return on investment, considering that interest rates are what, like 2% today.
It's a great return. How many companies can you say that about?
Not that many. At least not ones that are distressed. Right, you can look at like GraphTech, right, which is owned by Brookfield Business Partners. I'm a shareholder in GraphTech, but there's issues with GraphTech. There's a reason that it trades at the price it trades at. There are some issues with the company.
Mm-hmm.
Brookfield is not a distressed business.
Nope.
Yeah.
Oh, I got it. Look, if you look at slide 85, it's exactly what we're talking about. It's looking out 10 years.
Okay, yep.
So they have a little bit, how much weight should you put into this? I mean, not a lot, but it gives you a direction, right? That's the point. This is where we're heading. It gives you an idea. I wouldn't, by the way, if you look at their past number, every time they say a number,
under-promising, over-deliver. Yeah, but like right now, the market cap of Brookfield right now is $57 billion. And they're going to have $65 billion in net cash over the next 10 years. They're approximating.
Right.
Freaking billion dollars for a $57 billion market cap company.
Bye.
A little ridiculous.
There's
they said they're gonna reach. They want to return $10 billion in dividends. $10 billion they're gonna invest into listed partnerships, and then they can buy back $45 billion in stock. So here's another thing that doesn't get talked about, right? If the discount stays where it is to the plan value or widens, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they start getting more and more aggressive with their buybacks. Or some of the listed partnerships do buybacks. You remember Brookfield Property Partners did that tender offer earlier this year.
Yes, they did.
Right?
Yeah.
I participated in that, actually. It was a little arbitrage that I did, on a side note. But if they're doing all these massive buybacks and they can get buybacks at a good price, then the stock price goes even up more. And again, no one talks about any of this.
Well, the market's not rational.
But what I was saying, though, is even their slides don't talk about this. Their assumptions are not through buybacks. They're just saying this is what our company would be worth. Well, if you're buying back a lot of stock during that time, it's worth even more.
Do you know what was worth $45 billion?
I'm sorry?
Do you know that number, what it means? It's the former valuation of WeWork pre-IPO.
That's funny.
Isn't that hilarious?
That's kind of hilarious, yeah.
that, you know, it's obviously not a WeWork podcast, and that'd be a very, very interesting podcast just to take that thing apart. But it goes back to what you were saying. Like, some things are just doesn't make any sense. You can't figure out the numbers. Why is a market giving a valuation, you know, a certain asset at X price?
Because this is the environment that we're in. It's really, really sexy, and they get the, you know, all these young disrupt. If you're a disruptor, you get a high multiple. That's really what it comes down to right now.
Right. It's all about growth. You know, it's the environment we're in. It's mind-boggling. It's really, really weird.
I get it at some level, because you do have real disruption. I mean, Procter & Gamble is never going to be what it is again. You know, like, if people are waiting for the reversion of mean for Procter & Gamble, it's not going to happen. Yet those companies still trade at really high multiples. But Facebook trades at the same freaking multiple, and that's a disruptor with real growth and will be around in 10 years. And Facebook is what Procter & Gamble was in the 1960s.
Are you a Facebook bull?
Yeah, well, I'm just talking about in general. I mean, I own Facebook stock. But you can apply this to a lot of companies. Like, I don't own Google, but I would say the same thing about Google, is the brands of tomorrow are very different, and some of them are not being valued like that, right? So it's like the fact that some of these old school brands, even though their moats are eroding at a very high pace and have been since, you know, the last 20 years, that has not been fully recognized in the market. I've talked about this quite a bit on this show.
Yeah.
And I've written about it to my investors in my letters too. It's like, look, we're not buying these old staple companies trading at 30 times earnings. It's not worth 30 times earnings.
No, they're best.
These companies grow at like 1-2% a year. Like, look, someone our age, you know, do I buy a Duracell battery, or do I go on Amazon and buy an Amazon battery? I don't care. As long as it has good reviews and I know it lasts and it works, I'm going to buy the cheaper one.
It's definitely going to be harder for them.
It's going to be way harder for them.
They're not going to have the same moat as before. Before, you had a big brand, you bought the TV ads, and you had the best shelves. Now you can go direct to consumer. You put an ad on Facebook. Look at the Razor.
Yeah.
Look at Razor. They're taking market shares away from Gillette and
World. I mean, it's. I don't want to get too into this, but I mean, it's all these brands. There is massive disruption going on. My point was is that I look at Brookfield. This is another one of these businesses that is a disruptor. Just they're taking advantage of the trend in infrastructure growth and alternative asset management. That's their industry they're disrupting. Like, yep. I own Brookfield because I look at Brookfield somewhat in the same way that I look at Facebook, where it's a flywheel model and it's riding these, you know, one or multiple S curves, and that you can model a steep adoption cycle.
What's your favorite part about Facebook?
Well, the business model is one of the best business models I've ever seen in my life.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I think it's the first time in this podcast, so I have to go ahead and disagree a little bit with you.
Okay. Please.
Well,
please.
I like Instagram's great. I think that's the best part. The Instagram platform they bought for $1 billion, which is nothing.
Okay.
Nothing. That was one. I think it's probably one of the best investment, like, acquisition. One of the best acquisition ever was buying Instagram for $1 billion in stock at
the
time.
Yeah, and the more people on Instagram, the cheaper it gets to market to you know, for advertising, right? It's like it's the opposite of what things used to be, right? If you wanted to sell a razor, you know, let's go back to razors. If you wanted to sell a razor in the 1960s, you know, you'd have, you know, maybe you do like a little thing at your local supermarket or pharmacy or whatever, and then, you know, get some net recognition, then there's word of mouth, but word of mouth only goes so far. So then maybe you have to put on a radio ad, radio only goes so far, so now you have to spend more money and do a TV ad, And then if TV doesn't go, then you have to do a commercial for like the Emmys or the Super Bowl or something like that, which costs a shit ton. So the more market penetration you have, the more money it costs you. Facebook's the opposite, right? Where the larger scale, and Brookfield's the opposite. So I mean, I actually am putting them in the same category with this. The larger their scale, the cheaper it becomes to get market penetration. And they're in a market that's growing at a significant rate. So these are, to me, are incredible businesses. The larger they get, the better they get.
Yeah. No, I agree.
And you're paying low multiples for them.
Yes.
If Facebook exists in 10 years, I don't see how you don't make a lot of money with that. What? And if Brookfield exists in 10 years, I don't see how you don't make a lot of money with that.
Aren't you worried about the Facebook, the Facebook website or the app? Fatigue, the user engagement is down, right? If you look at the number, is the user in your Instagram? The Instagram part is fine, but the Facebook,
monthly active users keeps going up, dude.
Is it?
Yeah, I haven't. Let me again.
I was reading the opposite, that the key metrics are slowing down or. And the other thing is that young people. Are there young people? Are they on Facebook?
You have I think just in the United States alone, you have something like 200 or 300 million people using Facebook. Like it's the majority of the population in the United States.
Yeah. Well.
Age 25 to 34 is the most common age demographic.
What's the age?
The most common age, about 30% of the users are age 25 to 34.
Right. Okay.
But let's see here. So in quarter one, this is for the United States and Canada. They had 243 million active users. Quarter 2019, they had 244. And, look at quarter 17, it's 234. Quarter 1, 2017 is 234. So they're growing. But got to remember that worldwide penetration rate for the internet is still only at about 50%. So all these other countries that are going to have higher penetration for the internet, because that's another one of these adoption cycles that's still not at full adoption yet. As more countries come online, you're going to have faster growth with Facebook in those countries. And then Facebook ends up being a toll road for the internet because of all the advertising.
It's possible.
An incredible business. Like Google, it's the same thing. Like Google just keeps making – as worldwide penetration of the internet grows, Google makes more and more money. We've never seen businesses this good in the history of humankind before. And they're trading it, like normal multiples, which is kind of insane to me. Anyway, yeah. That's my view on companies like Facebook and Google. But let's go back to Brookfield.
Basically, if we want to their presentation, it ends. Bruce Flatt ends with four important points, right? He tells you, here's what I want to leave you with, is that Brookfield, their business is resilient and it's growing rapidly. So obviously, you want to hear that. It's good news. They're generating $2.5 billion in cash, and they believe that's going to more than double in 5 years. So let's say $6 billion in annual cash flow by 2023, 2024. And the carry is growing, so that's good. And the last point is that the excess cash flow, if they don't have anything good to do with it, they'll buy back shares and pay out dividends unless there's something better to do with that money.
So they're good capital allocators. They're not going to just buy back stock just for the sake of it. The interesting thing about this is that they trade at lower multiples than other asset companies and asset management companies.
Now, let's turn this thing around. Why do you think so?
I'm just going to ask you that, and I have some theories on that. I think one of them is that Brookfield doesn't fit perfectly into you know, it's not a perfect fit, right? It's kind of like a strange business where it's like they have this asset management company, but half their intrinsic value is in their listed partnerships. And then they own a 30% stake in their partnerships. And, you know, why don't they spin them off? Why aren't they internally? You know, it's like they're this like hybrid of a business where they have all these different things going on. And markets typically don't like companies that don't have a perfect industry fit.
Well, exactly. If somebody was new to investing and they heard, oh, you know, I heard Eric and Brian talk about Brookfield. Let me check this out.
It's a mess if you look at it on
screen. Yeah, it is.
Total mess. Yeah. And on top of that, if you don't really understand that there's this whole cultural, you know, competitive advantage, it's kind of hard to get – like it's a little hard to gauge the culture if you don't either, number one, have a background in culture, which I do, which most people don't. So I can see things that just most people can't, and that's the truth of it. The second thing is, you know, if you go to a Brookfield Investor Day and you experience being around employees and management – you sense they're a little bit different. You know, you don't have to have a background culture to experience that. That's a real competitive advantage that goes very, very underrated, right? So, you know, if you look at businesses that go from a, you know, a crappy culture to a good culture, I'm not going to go that deep into it, but that's the essence of it. Their profits go up, you know, somewhere between 300 to 500% on average within 24 months. That's the average increase in profitability. So it's a huge, huge value creator. Just having that good culture. The other thing, though, is that if you looked at a business that had these, you know, large stakes in listed partnerships, well, how do I know that they're not, that those listed partnerships aren't just asset gatherers, and that it's going to make a ton of money for the asset management business, aka the management, and they're just going to make shitty investments with the listed partnerships, and it's really just to serve management and for them to make a lot of money in the short term. Right, like, you know, if there was businesses that did that, on the surface, you could say, oh, this is a conflict of interest. This is a really inappropriate structure for a business. But Brookfield, I don't think so. I think it actually creates alignment because they're doing well for their investors with the listed partnerships. But that would be the case for every company. So there's a lot of these nuances and intangibles that you actually have to understand to get the Brookfield model.
It's not an easy company to understand. That's the main knock, the main critic. It's complex. It's a complex company. It's big.
Well, it's so yeah, I take issue to that. I don't think it's hard to understand. It's just that you're not going to understand it if you're thinking about it linearly. You have to think about it in a non-linear, big picture fashion. If you don't know how to think like that, then you're not going to understand. See, I personally find companies like this easier to understand, but that's the way that my mind works, and that's the way I've trained myself to think.
Well, there's an art to that, right?
So that's the thing. It is an art. It's not a thing you put into a fucking calculator.
And you know that's the thing.
This is purely an art, and you know I tell people all the time. You know, it's actually interesting, right? When people meet me and they go, oh, what do you do? Oh, I run an investment management business. I get funny looks sometimes, right? Because I play guitar, I sing, I play piano. I'm a very artistic person by nature, right? I have a background in like doing improv and comedy. And, you know, I do this podcast, right? Which is a form of artistic expression for me. People, when they're, well, why? And I'm not even that good with numbers, quite frankly. Like, I can't do like really fancy math in my head. Like I need to use a spreadsheet for most things. Like I'm not wired to be an engineer or any of that shit. And people are like, well, how do you work with investments? Like, cause what I do is an art. Like what I do is like, yeah, I can read a balance sheet and a cash flow statement and I can do basic calculations and understand what the ratios mean. But that's not that hard to learn, quite frankly. You know, if that's what made you a good investor, every fucking accountant in the world would be a multi-billionaire, but that's clearly not the case. And every economist would be a billionaire. That's clearly not the case. So
no.
Just being a good accountant, right? Like I would be a bad accountant just because like once you get past the nuances and like going to the hardcore number crunching, like I'm not interested. Like it's like my brain shuts down. So that's not my strength at all. I can force myself to do it, but I don't like doing it. That's like my least favorite part of the job. My favorite part of the job is this kind of stuff. It's the creative side. It's the part of understanding the nuances, figuring out the management, figuring out the culture. That's always been my competitive advantage with investing. And it's something that Buffett, by the way, is really good at, and Munger is really good at. And I just think that sometimes people who get attracted to value investing, they come in with a mind of an engineer, which is not appropriate for say, understanding businesses like this. They're just not going to get it if you're not trained to think like that. So it's 95% a creative act. The accounting is, and just reading the financial statements is, at least especially in this day and age, is not going to give you much of a competitive advantage unless you're doing like really, really tiny companies where you can find, you know, stuff and arbitrage and, you know, buy a local community bank getting bought out. But for the vast majority of, say, large investments someone might make, their competitive advantage is not going to be in having more information, because all this information, you know, we're in the age of the internet. They have plenty of information out there. You know, it's not like, you know, Buffett looking through the Moody's manuals and in the 50s and finding businesses at 2x earnings. That does not exist right now. If you're looking for that, you're not going to find it.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, it'd be really, really nice. It'd make things a lot easier, but that's not the world we live in. So
it is a harder world. It is tougher.
It's tougher. But I think in some ways it's interesting. Like just what I talked about with Facebook, right? Like most people don't talk about that with Facebook. I don't think that that's hard to get, but what I just said was clearly controversial. I don't even know to me, that's not controversial. What I just said to me, it's looking at Procter & Gamble in the '60s or looking at Geico in the mid-50s or something like that.
Right.
No, you're not buying it below book value, but book value at Facebook doesn't mean shit.
Well, not for that type of companies, right? It's we went from a tangible world to an intangible world. I think I saw something right. Like 80% of.
But see, that's a gift. This is what I'm trying to say. Going to an intangible world in respect to a business like Facebook is a gift to investors. Investors should be salivating that you can literally create value with almost no tangible assets. Like, holy shit, that's incredible. And if you're an investor, you should love that, because I don't have to go borrow, you know, money at like 6 to 8% to go build a railroad track. I'm serious though. Like, business, we can create so much more value than we could even 100 years ago. And people are complaining that it's too hard. It's like, holy shit, you have companies where your return on invested capital is higher than we've ever seen in the history of humanity. And these businesses make money. Oh, and by the way, the larger you get, the less your costs become. Like, that's the exact opposite of what we used to have. And the fact that these companies don't trade at like 50, 60, 70 times PE for most of the intrinsic value going to happen over the next 10, 20 years, like, you're buying, I mean, I remember Google trading at like 15, 20x free cash flow. Google.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Well, Google was considered an expensive IPO when it came out.
Yeah. Look, this goes back to if you ever read Good to Great by Jim Collins and learning about flywheel businesses, you know, so I like Brookfield. This is something, again, that really isn't talked about. I like Brookfield for the same reason that I like Facebook. That's why I'm in Brookfield, is because I'm taking advantage of this, you could almost call it a worldwide adoption cycle in alternative assets, both on the investment side and the asset management side. And Brookfield is in a position to take advantage of that.
Have you ever read Titan, the book about the Rockefeller?
I have, yeah. Thought it was kind of boring, to be honest.
It's a big biography. I like it.
I mean, it was okay. I thought it could have been a little bit more condensed, but that was okay. It was interesting.
Anyway,
yeah.
The point I'm making is, you know, it goes to back to what you're saying. Back then, it took a lot of money to make $1 billion. Like, think about the investment, right? The well platform, the rail tracks, the pipeline. Do you know how much assets you needed to make money? And now you have, you know, the Kardashians, one of the girls is worth $1 billion. All she does is put pictures on Instagram and, yeah, and sell makeup.
So Brian, one of the other things I like about Brookfield is as time goes on, less and less of their intrinsic value is tied to the listed partnerships and more of it is tied to their asset management business, which doesn't take much capital. You're managing assets.
Right. That's their business, right? It's growing the assets they have.
It's you're going to have a much higher multiple on that business. Like 1% of growth in that business is worth a lot more than 1% of growth in a listed partnership.
Yeah, but I like them having – I like their being invested in the partnership.
Oh, me too. I'm not saying I don't. But what I'm saying is that as the ratio between asset management business to listed partnership grows,
yeah,
if you're a Brookfield Asset Management shareholder, you should love that.
Well, that's Bruce Flatt's work, right? Because when he took over,
that is all Bruce Flatt's work.
It wasn't what it was. When he took over in 2003 or 2004, if I remember.
Matter the year. But yeah, that's Bruce Flatt's model right there.
Yeah. No, brilliant. It was good. It was good.
Let's go to some of the other listed subsidiaries. Let's talk about Brookfield Business Partners next.
Right. That was my favorite presentation.
Yeah. both of those guys, Dennis and then what was the CEO's name? Was it Cyrus? Was that his name?
Cyrus.
Yeah. They're a really sharp guy. I just spoke to Dennis on the phone this week for like an hour and blown away by this guy. He's amazing.
Right. Is that the CFO? The CFO, right?
CFO, yeah. So yeah. One of the interesting things, my favorite thing about the Brookfield – so let's just do a little recap about Brookfield Business Partners. So basically they're the private equity firm of Brookfield Asset Management, and they are – you know, they buy stakes in businesses and then they look to improve them and then they can sell them off when they're more stable to someone who's happy to buy them and make, you know, their steady, you know, 6-8% return.
Yeah.
What I like about them, though, is – so this is where I peaked. My eyes or my – just something peaked to me. You know, I peaked my interest. There we go. It was when they started talking about – I'm trying to look for the slide, but it was when they were talking about Westinghouse. And they – where is it? Hold on a second. Bum, bum, bum. Mm-mm-mm. Oh, Dennis Turcotte, he's the chief operating officer, not CFO, COO. Here we go, let's see.
Well, what I like about that presentation, I don't know if I like it better because it was at the beginning of the day, but what I liked about it, it was that's the baby of the family, right? That's the latest partnership, the latest listed partnership.
Yep.
And what I liked about it was that they finally have a track record and they can explain, like they have examples. He was going through example like Westinghouse, you know, here's what we did, here's what we saw, and here's what's going on now, and here's where it's going to go in the future. And, you know, nobody – Westinghouse was in bankruptcy, I think, when they bought it.
Mm-hmm.
But you looking at the slides?
Yeah, so I'll just go into it. There may just not be a good slide on it. It might just be more of the what he talked about. But he talked about – a lot about culture, and he was talking about that once they did all these cultural initiatives with these company, I think it was with Westinghouse, but with one of their portfolio companies, profits shot up. And I was like, oh, this is interesting, because most of the time, and now I'm saying this, you know, for those who are interested, I'll put this in the show notes. I did an interview with Scott Forgy, who's a colleague of mine, one of the best transformational coaches in the world. He's worked with over 100,000 people, companies. He literally took Lululemon from nothing to a $10 billion business in just a few years. and you worked with Chip Wilson. He, you know, you could say Scott is completely responsible for that cultural experience when you walk in the door, and it's retail, which is really fucking hard. And he's also turned around some other companies, which I can't talk about. And he works now, does coaching with the LinkedIn vice presidents, and works with some of the top teams at Google, and just gets them through business hurdles within a very short period of time. And then I did an interview with John King, who also has done a lot of transformational coaching, and he developed Tribal Leadership, which then became a New York Times bestseller, and is the most cutting edge work when it comes to transforming culture and elevating organizational culture. So I've done interviews with them. I'll put that in the show notes. But I've been trained in all this stuff, you know, and I got trained in all this stuff. Number one, I find it fascinating and interesting. And then the second thing is, as a value investor, I thought to myself, if I could do this with companies, I could create a ton of value for shareholders in a way that's much more reliable and more effective than, like, a, you know, 3G or Bill Ackman or any of these activists, right? That, you know, if you're successful even 30% of the time, that's considered successful. So when Dennis Turcotte was talking, and he's talking about doing these cultural initiatives, and this is what happened to profits and it's sustainable and blah, 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 I'm thinking, holy shit. Not only is this guy talking about it, he actually gets it. Because when most organizations talk about culture, they talk about it as almost this like form of virtue signaling, like, oh, look, we're so great because we value culture. Well, every fucking business says that, and they have their mission statement and their, you know, their statement of values and all that bullshit. But generally, that mission statement, their values and all that, it's not really embedded into the organization. There's, you know, there's many more companies that give lip service to it. Now, the second step to that is that even the companies where it is embedded, right, where they have their values and the employees really are aligned with those values and they've really built something interesting, the problem is that a lot of these companies don't actually know how they built it. Like, that's just how it ended up happening, and they wouldn't know how to recreate it. And then they go write a book about it, and no surprise, read the book and you can't actually apply anything because they had different circumstances and different people and different personalities. And if you tried doing the exact same thing, you would not get the same result. So most of these business books that talk about leadership and culture are really just like bullshit management books that don't really make much of a difference. And most of the executives that talk about culture either don't really know how they created it, or they are just giving lip service to it. So everyone knows what it's like to be at the effect of culture, right? So you could say, like, if you're flying in an airplane, Brian, and I mean, you've been in an airplane, right?
I've been in the what?
You've been in an airplane before, right?
Yeah, a few times.
Now, so you know what it's like to fly in the sky in an airplane, correct?
I've been at 30,000 feet, yep.
Yeah, but if I said, okay, now I want you to go build an airplane engine, would you know how to do it?
Nope.
No, totally different game.
And nobody would trust me doing that either.
Yeah, right. So this is what's interesting, is that in the world of business, or any kind of group of people, but just for the sake of this podcast, we'll talk about business. In an organization, if there's a really great culture, you know, I mean, you've been in an environment, everyone's been in environments where, like, oh, wow, it's really amazing. Like, there's something really special going on with this business or this organization. Everyone knows kind of what that feels like, and certainly everyone knows what it's like to not feel that, right? I mean, if you walk into, I don't know, your local DMV or something like that, or your local government bureaucracy, most of those offices are kind of dreary. There's not much world-changing behavior going on. It's pretty much not like a Berkshire or a Brookfield. And everyone knows what that feels like. Everyone also would kind of get that in a culture that's like some, you know, shitty government bureaucracy compared to a Brookfield or a Berkshire, there's just going to be more intrinsic value creation at the latter than in a bureaucratic setting like that. So everyone gets that. The difference is, just because you've experienced it doesn't mean you know actually how to cause it and create it. And the problem is that if you're on a management team of a great culture, that doesn't mean that you had anything to do with that culture. But a lot of these management teams go, oh, look at our great culture, and then they go write a book on it and how they did it. But if you read the book and how they did it, that's not actually how they did it, and they have absolutely no idea why their culture was actually so great. So they don't know how to recreate it. So at Brookfield Business Partners, Dennis stood out to me as this guy of like, wow, he gets it because he's implementing culture. He's clearly been trained in something and he's getting results. And my whole theory has been culture, actual transformation of organizations is the last bastion of value creation in business, period. You know, if you look at, you know, all of these things that have been developed in business school, some things are good, some things are really shitty and not good. But generally, when it comes to making things more efficient, right, you know, so here we can cut some costs. You don't need to have this many employees. Here's best practices. People have got that down pretty damn good. Like, there's not much more value you can squeeze out of that.
Right.
But when it comes to culture, I mean, literally, so right now, if I look at all public companies, about 75, maybe slightly less, but say 70%, about 70% of businesses right now today, if I went in and did culture work with them, within 24 months, the average company would have an increase in profits of somewhere between 300 to 500%. That's not 3 to 5%, 300 to 500%. It's an actual non-linear breakthrough in performance. It's a gigantic difference. Now, I'm working on a project right now, and this is why I reached out to Dennis. I'm working on a project right now with Scott Forgy, who I had interviewed. And by the way, full disclosure, I'm not offering to sell a security or anything. I don't have a fund doing this right now, so I can't even offer something. But my whole vision is I wanted to start a fund where I had a chunk of capital. I go and buy a somewhat meaningful stake in some of these businesses, kind of like how Brookfield Business Partners already does, and either work with the management or replace the management and teach the management and the employees about this stuff so they can do it on their own and actually elevate their own organization without having to change people or without having to impose something on people, because people don't like that. You become the flavor of the week or flavor of the month. They look at you as some stupid consultant, which you actually would be. And then you leave and you'd actually make no difference. It would just be like, you know, some temporary shit. And if you look at, you know, there's a famous quote by Peter Drucker. I don't know if it's actually by Peter Drucker, but it always gets attributed to him. That says, culture eats strategy for breakfast every day. And it's essentially that you can have the greatest business strategies, but if you don't have a culture that's aligned with the strategy, the culture will always destroy it. This is why you have such a breakthrough in performance. So I've just seen this, is that one of the reasons this is such an amazing opportunity is, number one, for Brookfield Business Partners is, and for what I'm doing is, number one, it works. I mean, I mean, John King, who I interviewed, I mean, he's been doing this for 30 years. Scott Forgy has been doing it for probably around that same time. These guys have all done it successfully in the private sector. The problem for me when building this project was that these guys didn't know about investing, right? To find people who could even understand value investing, which is a whole counterintuitive world on its own. Most people don't get value investing. You know that, Brian, right?
No, it's a weird breed of people.
Super weird breed of people. So I'm trying to actually find two weird breeds of people, like an extra weird breed of person that can get both. Because the problem is that I have found in the coaching world, the ones that are like doing real, like really deep, good work, they tend to not get value investing because, think about it for a second, right? They're so open. They're just in this world of possibility. They're constantly creating. And they're going to be more into like working with a business in Silicon Valley, or they're going to be working with some really sexy startup. they're not going to get the whole value thing, and they're more likely to like work with some new crypto firm, right, or a marijuana dispensary. On the flip side, though, it's basically all the companies that we bash, like those people are more likely to work with like Intelray and all that, right? On the flip side, though, this is what's really interesting, is that people who are value investors, like when I'm looking at a business, right, my first instinct, right, when I looked at Brookfield Management isn't like, oh, let me see what kind of sexy shit Bruce Flatt's doing. Let me go create with him. No, it's let me look to see Bruce Flatt's a fucking liar and see if he's cooking the books and see if the guy's a total scam artist. And I'm actually looking to distrust people. And I'm choosing to be cynical about life. I'm choosing to be closed off. And I'm choosing to be very distrustful and skeptical. It's a completely different hat and lens that I'm putting on when I'm doing that initial research and continuous research on businesses. That lens, if you're working with people in a coaching relationship, doesn't work. It's really bad. Like, you're going to be really ineffective. And you're going to create probably the opposite of what you're committed to. The thing is that a lot of people who get into value investing, they're actually like that in their entire life. They're very cynical, jaded, closed off people. Makes them great investors, makes them really, really shitty with people.
They're skeptics.
Well, no, they're cynics. I'm a skeptic. I'm not a cynic, right? So you could say being a cynic is not only you skeptical, but you're closed off as well. Right, you're looking for the worst. There's going to be probably a large chunk of people even listening to the show where I'm saying this stuff, and they're going to say, "Oh, that sounds like a scam," or "Oh, he's probably just pushing some MLM," or like literally just like caca crazy shit that people say when they feel threatened by something or it doesn't fit into their box, right? Which is fine. But the opportunity for a company like Brookfield Business Partners, and Brookfield, quite frankly, is because most people are either cynical about this kind of stuff or just aren't even interested in learning about it, even after they hear all this stuff, right? I guarantee you most people listening to this aren't going to be like, oh my God, what did he just say? I need to like go get myself trained and learn about all this stuff so I can have a competitive advantage in my business. Most people aren't going to do that. And that's the competitive advantage, is that no one really is doing this. And no one, there's nobody has a fund that's combining these two things. No one's actually doing it. I wanted to work for a fund that did this and no one was doing it, which is why I decided I was going to start this on my own.
So is that what you're doing? You're starting a fund?
I'm not starting a fund right now, but I'm open to working with anyone. I will say this, if you have a fund right now and you want to make cultural changes at your businesses and can create shit tons of value, I can absolutely help, and Scott and I can absolutely help. And we want to build a track record in our own right so we can eventually launch a fund. So yes, I'm putting that out there for anyone listening right now. So far in the year that I've been reaching out to people, only one person has gotten this, and we're working with an activist right now. We've had two, I'm not going to get into specific names for actually legal reasons that I can't talk about it, but we've gone through two proxy contests so far, got fucked both times, so it hasn't worked out yet. And this particular activist wanted to do proxy contests. That's what he's good at. So, but it's not a requirement for me. Like if management was there, I could still be effective with them. I don't have to be, kicking out management. Just with this particular activist, I'm kicking out management.
I don't know anything about this, and maybe your listeners, I don't know if they know anything, but how does that work? You take a stake in a company.
Well, with this one, it would be different, right? It would be different.
Do I change your culture or the approach?
So here's the thing. If I had my own capital, I could do it my own way, but I'm at the mercy of whatever, you know, hedge fund wants to help me because, you know, my business has, you know, right now roughly $3 million in capital and, you know, I need a lot more than that to do this. But the activist I'm working with right now, they specialize in proxy battles. So the agreement that I have with them is you go do a proxy battle, you know, at a company that you think is undervalued and has cultural issues. So that's where I come in and I say, okay, yes, we can make, I can make a difference here. You know, this is actually something that I can make a difference. Then we have someone who we would put up for election to the board.
So they get board seats.
Get board seats. And it would be someone who not only has a background in this kind of cultural work and with tribal leadership, but also who has some expertise with this particular business as well. So it hasn't been me running for a board, but I've found other people who are trained in this work who also would be good skill set fits for the board as well. So you want both. And then the process would be, once you have board control and you have someone who is trained in tribal leadership to be on the board, now we can go teach this work to management and also some groups of employees. And what that would look like is I'd probably come in, Scott and I would probably come in for, like a 2-day training at the beginning. It'd be very, very, long, intense days. And then we'd probably come in, depending on what was needed, maybe every 4 to 6 weeks for, a half day follow up. And then in between, we'd probably do some one-on-one phone coaching with some of the management when things came up. And we'd do that, we would do that for probably for a smaller size business for our work to be complete. You know, it would take anywhere from, say, the low side, 6 months to 2 years.
I like I said, I don't know a lot about this. And obviously, I know that culture is obviously very important and it characterizes, an organization, its nature. But how, the easy, how do you explain it? How do you go in a company that already has a culture and say, hey, we're going to change it? How do you change a culture?
Yeah, I would say, long story short, go check out some of the interviews that I've done with Scott and John. I've done two interviews with John, one interview with Scott, and you'd get some more insight. I'd also recommend to any of the listeners, and I don't get any, compensation for this other than, just creating awareness and teaching, because I like to do that. The book Tribal Leadership outlines a lot of this in their book, and it's still a tip of the iceberg look, but at least it gives some insight onto how it works. You're not imposing your opinions on what a culture should be. So a lot of what people call culture work is actually just a consultant coming in and trying to just change things and shake things up and tell people what to do. That never works sustainably. So the vast majority of people who do business consulting are doing management change and management techniques and tactics. That is very, very surface level. I'd call it amateur shit. And it only has minimal effectiveness and typically is pretty poor effectiveness long term. And you can obviously get benefits with cost cutting and stuff like that, but that's not anything transformational. That's just using some business technique to make things more efficient. That's not what I'm interested in. It's important, but it's not what I'm interested in. What you would do, right, is you would start essentially reorganizing the way that people are in relationship to each other and the way that people are relating to each other. So you're not changing people, but, let's say, for instance, Brian, that the two of us both worked at Westinghouse together, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
we're both nuclear engineers.
We're both nuclear engineers, but we actually have this love for, say, value investing, and we have this love for, workability in organizations. That's something that actually we're passionate about. Well, imagine if we didn't know that we were into that, and I was relating to you as this weird little French guy, and you were relating to me as this quirky, nerdy American dude who's into nuclear engineering. We would be working in a very, you could say, we'd have a very much a commodity based relationship where, you can help me with this thing, I can help you with this thing, but we're nuclear engineers. But if now all of a sudden we have this whole new background of relatedness and we're interacting in a way that where our own core values are resonating with each other. Well, now you have Joe Schmo, who's also a nuclear engineer, interacting with us, and he starts resonating with what's showing up between us, and then it impacts him. And now you have this, you have what's called a triadic relationship, where you have three people essentially connected whose, you could say, core values are resonating with each other at a very authentic level.
A triad?
Triadic relationship, as opposed to a dyadic relationship, which is, you know, a one-on-one connection, and it's not based on anything deep other than, you know, someone's personality or someone's stereotype or someone's position at work. And that's you know, about 75% of organizations are constructed of those kinds of dyadic relationships. So when you move from these, you know, commodity-based dyadic relationships to a bunch of these value-based triadic relationships, and then you start combining the triadic relationships with each other, now you start forming real partnerships, actual teams versus the bullshit team building. And so this is the problem. Like, if you have an organization where the cultural structure isn't there, and you have some consultant come in and say, oh, we're going to do a bunch of team building today to get us all connected, it doesn't do anything because you're not changing the structure. You're just putting a Band-Aid on it. It's not going to do anything. It's just going to feel fake, and it's now a bunch of commoditized people doing team building, which just creates more of the same shit. And all the employees know it's bullshit, and they just play along because if they don't, they get fired. So you're actually, instead of doing new strategies with people, you're altering the structure first, and then out of the new structure comes all of these new strategies naturally, which then become aligned with the new culture. I can't go deeper into that without spending, you know, 10 hours with you, but that's a very, very general way of doing it.
That's the Cliff Notes?
That's the Cliff Notes, yeah.
Have you ever read Phil Jackson, the basketball coach?
Yeah, he's great.
Is that similar? Because he talks about that tribal, the culture.
Yeah,
the
Phil Jackson's a huge fan. So Phil Jackson, I could be wrong about this. Let me Google this so I make sure I'm like not saying something that's like completely blasphemous on my show, because I'm actually kind of protective of John. Yeah, so Phil Jackson, yeah, I'm right about this. Phil Jackson is a huge fan of John. So John King, the guy I interviewed on my podcast, he created Tribal Leadership. Dave Logan co-wrote a book with him, but Dave's not the guy that created it. It was John who invented the stuff. Phil Jackson is a huge fan of Tribal Leadership. I thought that was correct. I just didn't want to say something that was bullshit on the show like that. So yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I read the book, and I know that was one of his things, the different degree of culture, like the acceptance and the believing, and you know, he makes good points. Everybody can go out there and talk about basketball or coach basketball. You know what I mean? But what's the difference between, you know, somebody who's just smart about basketball, who knows a lot about basketball, and can actually coach it, communicate it, and take a team that's been the bottom, you know, the bottom of the standings to so many championships? And very often, how do you deal with people with so many different personalities, especially in the basketball team with Jordan and all these people?
Yeah, so one of the key things to get there is relating to someone at the level of personality is a very shallow way to connect with someone.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you think of Gandhi, right? I'm going to use Gandhi as like the stereotypical example of this. You don't relate to Gandhi based off his personality. I mean, you might, but if you know anything about Gandhi, you probably don't. You probably connect with him at the level of what, you know, like some kind of noble cause that he was committed to, which was peace. When you think of Gandhi, most people think of peace, not he was a weird little bald man who cheated on his wife and you know, just like did all kinds of weird sexual rituals. Like, people don't think about that, but he didn't. He did do all that. But that's not the level that people related to him to.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. I know.
So you can say that.
I know Gandhi, the peacemaker.
Right. Yeah, and most people do. Look, Martin Luther King, the same thing, right? I mean, he was like pretty verbally abusive to people and like did some pretty horrible shit. But that's not. the place where he lived his life from and that people connected to him.
Well, he wasn't looking for that.
Right. So you could say that the lowest level, right, you can relate to someone to is their stereotype, right? And then sort of the degree above that is their reputation, right? So Warren Buffett talks a lot about reputation, 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 which is more effective than stereotype. But then being related to your values in some kind of noble cause, God, and I feel like I'm just sounding very cliche corporate right now, but it's really true. The being related to a noble cause is the highest level. And when you literally can build a company where people are related to each other from their noble cause as opposed to their reputation or stereotype, magical things start to happen. Like magical things start to happen naturally without forcing it or having some consultant push it. And by the way, it's not just business. I mean, it's sports too, or in families, or in a synagogue or a church. It doesn't actually matter, or a nonprofit. It's any group of people those things start to happen. It just so happens that in business, because people are performing better, profits skyrocket. But that's in business.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's the thing is to team up somebody, change the world. And apply some of these.
In this situation, you don't have to change your board to be effective with this. That's just the way that I'm doing it with him.
Now, is there any companies that investor can look up to where John King or Scott's approach has been applied? Is there any
case study like Lululemon?
Lululemon, yeah, you mentioned that.
Zappos, they're not they're owned by Amazon, but Zappos is another one of these businesses that's done it. There's a few others, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say or not, so I'm just not going to. But yeah, there are businesses that have been impacted, quite a few actually.
Oh, I'll have to research that. John King, you said Tribal Leadership, that's the book?
Yeah, that's the book.
Okay, I'll have to look that up. Interesting.
Yeah. Sorry,
I don't know a lot about it, so I probably should polish my cultural.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you can get it intellectually, but until you experience it, it doesn't really make much of a difference.
Right.
Because it's not an intellectual thing. Like there's plenty of people who just know lots of academic work about culture, but that doesn't mean they can apply it in a very experiential way. That's the problem, actually, quite frankly, with a lot of this transformational coaching stuff is for everything that's like actually legitimate, there's like 100 other things that are absolute garbage.
It's an
like, I hate most self-help books. I find them completely bullshit and just like ridiculous. And they have a lot of really nice sounding principles and platitudes, which are great in theory, but it's like, yeah, go fucking apply it. Good luck. If you don't have that kind of background. I mean, to tell someone, like, oh, just go love yourself and everything's great. Well, yeah, sure. But knowing to love yourself is different than experiencing loving yourself.
What about positive thinking?
Bullshit. It's like positive thinking is literally, I'm going to go think a bunch of positive shit, on top of negativity. Well, what does that create? More negativity. Whipped cream on shit is still shit. But I'm going to think really positive about it. No, it's still shit. Now you're just working really hard to resist it. Well, what you resist persists. And actually, you become what you resist. So good luck. Positive thinkers, good luck. Yeah, it's funny. It's like people who think positive, they're like, well, you're a positive thinker. Oh, but what you're not seeing is that everyone around you occurs as negative to you. So you're negative about negative people. Interesting, but you're so fucking positive. Good luck. Okay. Go drink some kombucha and sing kumbaya and go meditate. Like,
I like kombucha.
I like kombucha too. It becomes like a whole personality identity around some of those things, and it gets very, very degraded from its original purpose. To me, it's the equivalent in the investing world of I'm a value investor. I buy things with low PE ratios. And like that's the extent of it. It's like, oh, okay, I think you kind of missed the point of like what you mean by value investing.
Well, I mean, there's so many shades, you know.
You
shades.
Know what I mean, though. You know what I mean.
No, I do. A lot of industries are
so there's like, this, so there's this like there's just like a watered that when most people talk about things like we're doing a transformational initiative or we're looking at culture and transforming the culture, but it's just it becomes these like watered down buzzwords. So to go back to Brookfield Business Partners, what moved me about watching Dennis up there was I was like, holy shit, this guy is the real deal. And I've come across under five people in my life in the world of business where I could say that about.
So what struck you? Like, what is it that – because you saw something that I did not see.
I did. Yeah, well, no, I don't think anyone saw it. I mean, there might have been someone. But, I mean, unless you had a background for this, there's no way you would have saw it. I mean, because he was so – the way his mood changed. I mean, he had this way of being where he was so passionate. And he's saying, okay, when we did all this cultural stuff, all of a sudden – here's what happened to our performance at the company. And these were, you know, drastic performance changes. So already I'm like, okay, if you were just giving lip service to culture, you're not actually talking about the actual performance that sustainably changed when this happened. Also, you're not going to talk with this kind of passion, knowing that most people aren't going to understand it. If anything, usually the way you know someone doesn't get it is they're not talking about that kind of data. And they're talking in this like really corporate speak, like, oh, we're really passionate, we're really committed to these values, and here's our mission statement, here's our statement of values. Well, we're so proud of it, and our employees are proud of it too, and blah, 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 blah. Like, that's usually how it is. But this guy was saying things knowing that most people weren't going to get it. You know, even when I walked up to him, and I said, you know, about that culture thing, and blah, 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 and he started apologizing to me. He goes, yeah, you know, it's just something I'm really into. I don't know if it really added much. I'm like, dude, that's why I'm talking to you right now. And he's like, oh. So, you can just kind of feel it. It's kind of like when you meet someone. Here's the best analogy I would make. You know, you have a background in value investing. Most people listening to this podcast probably do. You talk to someone who has a value investing background, and like you can instantly get that they get it. Like, they don't have to talk much for you to be like, oh, yeah, this guy's one of us. But then there are those people who've done like, you know, nothing against like Phil Town, but it's like, you know, like rule number one investing. And they've done like one course with him. Like, they call themselves value investors and you just hear them talk. Or you just have someone who's like learned about value investing in business school, but like they clearly don't get it. And you can tell within like 2 minutes of talking to them that they're just giving lip service to value investing, but they don't really get it. It's kind of like that.
No, you get it or you don't.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like when people are like, yeah, so one of our strategies here at the blah, blah, blah funds is value investing. And we think value is one of those interesting styles. And we tend to lately we've been into the value style because we think that value is primed based off our indicators to come back into favor. And we're going to take advantage of that potential alpha with the blah, blah, like. It's like, holy shit, like, you don't get what you're talking about right now. You're not a value investor.
Yeah, Warren Buffett talked about that once. Like, I don't know, he was asked, like, can you learn this or are you born with this or can you? And you know, I know he was saying something like, for some people, and I resonate with that, for some people, the idea of buying a dollar for 50 cents, their eyes open, right? They know, they understand it. That's value investing. And for other people, it just doesn't matter in what way you put it. It just doesn't resonate. Like, what do you mean by a dollar for 50 cents? What? Like, it's – and I don't know. To me, it's an extension of my personality. Like, I wasn't – you know, I was you can call it a value investing before I even knew what that was. I didn't even know what value investing was, you know, Warren Buffett and all that stuff. I was just in my nature of finding something, whether I was at a grocery store, whatever, get more value from what I'm buying was always ingrained in my brain. And then, you know, investing is just a way of applying that.
You know what's interesting, Brian? Did you ever read the book by Annie Duke, Thinking in Bets? You ever read that?
No, I have not.
So I'm actually going to say I don't recommend it for you. I don't think you would get much out of it. Now, it's one of these books that are considered like, you know, it's revolutionary and it's so incredible and blah, blah. But the thing is, if you already, and you know, she mentions Berkshire Hathaway in the book too, which is, I think, why some of the value community started, you know, she talks about Berkshire Hathaway, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, everything she's talking about, you already do as an investor, where she's talking about looking at life as a series of probabilities. And how in poker, poker players understand this, right? Where if you lose a game in poker, it doesn't mean that you made the wrong decision. These probabilistic scenarios typically are not understood by most people. It's like a very, it's like a breakthrough in thinking for a lot of people that just because you made the right decision doesn't mean that you have the right outcome, that like the outcome you want.
Right.
It's focusing on the process and looking at life as a series of probabilities and bets.
Yeah. Well, I took a stack course. It helped me.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. But yeah, as an investor, investors get that already. You know, you're not, it's like, even when we look at Brickfield, like we're talking about, well, if this happens or this happens, like it's a position, it's a bigger position for me. Because I see that there's all these range of outcomes that could happen, and I do like kind of okay to really, really good. So that's a bet I want to capitalize on.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So not read the book? It sounds like I should read it.
No, I don't think so, because I don't think you'll get anything. I think it'll just be like, oh, okay, I already get all this stuff. Like, I don't think you'll learn much.
Oh, okay, I got you. Okay.
But what was amazing to me more so was that, like, you look at the reviews, and it's like this, like, groundbreaking book, and it's like, oh, this is literally what I already do.
Okay.
So,
well, it looks like I don't need to read it now because you just told me what it's about.
I just don't think you'd learn much from it. It's a good book. I just don't think for you would get a lot out of it.
I wish you would teach me how to play better poker.
Who, me?
No, her. I wish you'd teach me how to be a better poker player.
I think you have a mind for poker. I used to be pretty good. I haven't played in, like, I used to play a lot in high school and in college. I was pretty good. But again, if you know how to think like this, you can be pretty damn good at poker.
Yeah. I haven't played in years. That'd be fun to play, actually. I don't.
David Einhorn, right? I mean, he's really fucking good. Like he makes money from poker.
Is he good, or he just shows up at these events?
No, I think he's gotten far before. Hold on, David Einhorn. I'm pretty sure he's gotten like pretty far. Let's see here. From 2018. Hedge fund billionaire Einhorn places six in major poker tournament. Einhorn
is that
plays
World Series of Poker, the big one?
I don't know if it was that one, but
because I know he's known in the poker circle, but you know, some people just pay their fees and they're in. And...
Yeah, he's pretty good. I've heard he's pretty good.
Well,
yeah,
good for him.
Yeah. Let's. Anyway, I think I want to continue with the Brookfield stuff. I love the conversation. I like that we can go all kinds of places. The Brookfield Business Partners presentation was interesting. And they just talk about, you know, value creation through essentially you're buying these undervalued businesses, what you think are undervalued. And then you're improving them through either operational efficiencies or cultural efficiencies or both. So there's, right. There's a ton of competitive advantage doing that, and you know they're buying assets that are under and then they're selling the assets once the businesses are more stabilized, and they can go sell them to someone who wants a more stable company. But what they're not doing is using crazy leverage and just hoping for the best and trying to do these like leveraged buyouts. So they operate a little bit differently than your typical private equity firm. Yeah, and they do some estimates at the end of their presentation saying, you know, we look at EBITDA multiples of, you know, 9 to 10 times for some of these companies, 8 to 9, 10 for the industrials. Some of them they do at market price, they're publicly traded entities, and then For some of the newer companies, they just do it at cost. So they have a company called HealthScope and a business called Clarios, and they just mark it down as cost since they haven't done much with the businesses yet. And they give you a range of a per total, per unit. So that's Brookfield Business Partners. Is there anything you wanted more to say about that before we move on to infrastructure partners?
Well, for your listeners, if you know, if there's one presentation to look at, it would be that one. The Brookfield Asset Management, yes, but in the partnerships, that was the one I liked the most.
I think infrastructure was interesting too. I don't know. I liked them all. I thought the least interesting was renewables. I didn't get much out of the renewable presentation.
Yeah, I missed it. That was.
I'll give you the rundown of the renewables. The renewable presentation essentially says, you know, even though the returns on capital are pretty low for renewables, we can get into some distressed renewable stuff and make higher returns without taking without taking as much risk, you know, only taking moderate risk, but making the returns of, you know, high risk projects essentially. So they're lowering the risk by making things more efficient. And then they also talked about how the bridge people thought that natural gas was going to kind of be this like bridge between coal and total renewables. But they have found that the adoption for renewables has happened a lot faster than they predicted, and that it's likely there won't be a need for a bridge anymore, that we're just going to go straight to renewables. So that was really interesting. So there's a lot more growth in that than they originally believed, even just like 2 years ago.
Yeah, they're good at recycling assets.
That's true for all their businesses. But anyway, that was the nutshell of renewables. Otherwise, I thought it was kind of boring, to be honest. With infrastructure, I think their infrastructure business is also interesting because the big takeaway that I had from infrastructure, you know, they go into FFO per unit and all that, but I think the big thing I have is that, again, you're dealing with these very large projects, right? So you need scale to even buy them and operate them.
Yeah.
But then what's interesting is do you remember they used a word?
Oh, they created a new term. Yes.
Yeah.
What was it?
I'm looking for it right now.
I'm looking for it right now.
So it's like they say so. Yeah, so they start with saying they have these high-quality cash flows that are stable, recession-resistant, very much utility-like in that respect. But then they'll say that our business also delivers much higher growth relative to your traditional utility. And then they talk about that they have an attractive valuation compared to their peers, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so they said we have security plus growth. So they say it's owning a growtility.
Growtility, yeah.
Super cheesy. Yes. It was kind of funny.
Yeah, the crowd reacted to that.
Yeah. My two, I think long term, my two favorite, long term in terms of just like, you know, forget about valuation for a second, but in terms of just like business operation performance, I think Brookfield Business Partners and Brookfield Infrastructure are probably my two favorites in terms of business performance over time for the LPs.
Yes,
I think I've actually been buying property partners for some of the for the retirement accounts that I manage, because I think property partners is the most undervalued.
Yeah, and then they have done what, 30% last year. They have done very, very well.
Yeah, they've done really well. Was there anything you wanted to talk about infrastructure partners before we go into property?
No, you covered it.
Okay. I mean, I just want to go into like the basics. We don't have to go into like the weeds on that. With real estate, though, so their property partners is like a lot of their real estate malls. The CEO is talking about how he feels like their stock is basically being valued like a mall company, isn't it? Like a mall REIT, because they own some malls.
That's Brian Kingston, right?
Yeah. But it's like, you know, when you do the numbers, it's pretty compelling. Like it's going to be hard to lose money on this investment. And they have a great real estate business. They also sometimes will build their own businesses too. Like they went to that in the presentation where they built like a student housing business literally from scratch. But you look at the valuation and the company is trading at like a significant discount to the net asset value of the company. The other potential room for value creation in terms of just a pure valuation, you know, intrinsic value compared to the stock price, is they said, you know, if interest rates stay low, which, you know, isn't a given, but just say potentially, just like, you know, the extra $20 per share per 100 basis points for the asset management, if you look at where cap rates are, as the 10-year note has gone down, cap rates have not changed with that. So either interest rates go back up or cap rates will come down to follow suit with interest rates. So that was like an extra little boost right there. And yeah, I mean, they've done really well. I think they have a really solid investment business.
It is misunderstood.
Yeah. So again, it's a hodgepodge of assets, right? It's buildings, it's the Canary Wharf, it's malls. Malls are really scary, so that doesn't get any love in the market these days. But they're investing in all these experiential buildings, right? So they understand that experience is going to give you higher rent rates. So they're really, really well managed. And, you know, they grow moderately. And especially if you own them in an IRA, I mean, it's a great return because you're not paying taxes on any of that. And you get a valuation. So, you know, they say with the current multiple, you have a potential for a 14% investment rate of return. But then if cap rates go up, you can then get to a 33% investment rate of return in a 4% cap rate environment over the next few years. So, you know, you're buying a company that's growing, trades at a pretty big discount to net asset value. And if cap rates go down, you make even more money. I think it's probably a good investment. But then in a tax-free account, I think it's incredibly one of these safe and cheap investments.
I think it's the listed partnership. I think it's the LP with the highest distribution, I think, of all.
Oh, definitely. It's close to 7% right now, that yield.
Right. No, it's and they grow it every year, right? It keeps growing.
Yeah, they keep growing it. I mean, and those are going to, you know, even if interest rates go up, I mean, it's still going to grow. It's just that the underlying asset might be worth less, but then they're going to take those cash flows and buy cheaper buildings with it. So, I'm not that worried about where interest rates go because these are good businesses.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, my takeaway from all this was,
I mean, unless you think like interest rates are going like 9% or something like that, that completely changes it. But
well, you shouldn't be in equity.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's the point. Everything will get wrecked. But I think people call the death of the mall. That's the thing in the paper, right? It's the death of the mall. I think yes, there are malls that will die, and they bought a big one last
year. I mean, some of the really like shitty malls in like rural areas, like a lot of those are going to go away.
Well, these guys are Class A or Double A. Like they bought the best malls.
So right? it's the best malls, but the portfolio came with like a few shitty malls too.
Yeah.
Where even if those get marked down to zero, it's still a good investment. Like it just like came with it, basically.
I think what Brian Kingston says is like, look, we bought 1,000 malls with the JP acquisition. I don't remember what it's called. They bought it last year, and they came with about 1,000 or 1,100 malls. And he said 20 to 30% of those might have to close or redevelop or do something else with it.
Right, but that's the thing. Like they're factoring that into the mall, into their business model. Like it's not a surprise.
And the rest of it is redevelop or rezoning. Like they're doing things with it, you know.
Yeah, all those IRR numbers that they project assume that those malls are shitty.
Yeah, it's like, hey, what are you doing with Sears? You know, no, it's going to be something else. You know, have you seen the Ala Moana Center, the mall in Hawaii?
No.
Oh, look, Ala Moana Center.
Is it cool?
Oh, dude, it's beautiful.
How do you spell that?
Ala, A-L-A. Then the second word is Moana. M-O-A-N-A.
Okay, yeah, I see it.
It's the Moana. I don't know if it's the biggest in the States or one of the biggest. But that thing, that it's not going away.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. That's wow. That's super nice. Wow.
Like, you go there, you know, you'll go there with your date, have dinner.
That literally is, like, a stereotypical, like, if there was to be a nice mall in Hawaii, that's, like, what it would look like, too.
Yeah. That's what they own. They own this.
Right, yeah.
And they're going to do, you know, more things with it. They're going to add real estate, condos, hotels. Yeah, I think the story is over negative. On, you know, they're like, oh, they own malls, sell. Yeah. Well, that's not it, you know. Yes, they do own malls. They own the best mall. 20-30% of them will either close or do be something else. The other 70-80% is good malls. But
yeah,
it's the death of the mall. You know, Amazon will kill you. All that stuff. You know what Amazon's doing? They're
taking over the world.
Well, they're taking over the world, but they're going through offline shopping now.
Well, in Brookfield Place, they have those stores in that store.
The what's it called? Amazon Go? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I bought something from there actually right before the meeting. I bought like a little snack.
Yeah, I want to check it out.
It's pretty cool.
So you download the app. Is that what it is?
Yeah, you download the app and then like you scan it walking in and then you like pick out what you want and you leave.
Okay, that's it, huh?
It's really, it was a little weird. I felt like I was shoplifting. I was like, oh, this has got to be what it feels like. This is terrifying. All
right. Well, that's the future of shopping, right?
It's funny. After I left, I went over to my Amazon app to like make sure it like charged the right items. I was like so like paranoid. I was actually shoplifting.
So this is linked to your Prime account, which is linked to your credit card. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's linked to your credit card. You just pick it up.
I don't think you need a Prime account though. I think you just need an Amazon account. I have a Prime account, so I could be wrong, but I don't know if you need a Prime account for that. I don't think so.
And you pick stuff up off the shelf.
Yeah, you put it in the basket. Grab it. Yeah, you just grab it and go.
And it just scans out.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Why am I amazed, but at the same time not like.
When I know. It's just, you know why? Because it's such an amazing piece of technology, and then you're not, because, of course, Amazon would do that.
Why wouldn't, like, it sounds like
here's
everybody
the thing,
would
like, doing, like Amazon's going to have, like, teleportation. It's like things are just going to, like, show up in your living room, and you'll be like, oh, that's amazing. No, it's not that cool. It's
Amazon. They already have Alexa.
Yeah, but imagine just, like, a couch appearing in your living room. Just like appearing, just like materializing from nothing, and you just being like, "Oh, that's so cool!" Oh no, it's just Amazon, whatever.
Yeah, you're just not surprised if somebody else like, how do you do that? But I'm like, okay, Alexa.
I think the future is like you're gonna have these smart homes where like refrigerators like restock themselves, and your kitchen's gonna like cook for you, and that's all coming. That shit's all coming, man. Whether you like it or not, it's all coming. Robots are taking AI, robots, all that shit's all taking over the world.
Yes. Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Robots, software are eating the world.
Yeah. Is there anything else Brookfield related or are you
No, I think we touched it. I know we want to talk about Investors Day. I mean, if I can
recap. I'll put a link for the slides up there on the show notes and I'll link to the Tribal Leadership book and any other interesting shit we talked about, I'll put up there on ericschlein.com. If you wanna contact me or check out more podcasts, ericschlein.com/podcast, and you can find all the our Intelligent Investing podcast on there, including some of our wonderful, lovely shows that we've had with Brian.
Hey, this was great.
Yeah, this was great. Brian and just tell listeners what your blog and best way to contact you again is.
Right. So Brian Langis, B-R-I-A-N, Langis, LANGIS.com. You can find, that's my blog. I blog about random things. And then I have a Twitter account. I don't know my handle. It's like Absolute.
Yeah, I'll put it on the show notes.
Yeah, it's absolute Brian. Absolute underscore Brian.
Yeah, and you'll do you're gonna do another blog post on this, so people have a thing to read.
I might. If I get the time to put it together, it might take a little bit of time, but yeah, usually I'll do a little recap.
Okay, yeah, I think people have said nice things about your recap, so just so you know.
Thank you.
I've gotten some good comments on that.
Happy to hear that.
Yeah. It's nice because some people, they may not want to listen to the whole thing. They want to read a little thing, or maybe they want to read something first before they listen. So, you know, it's nice. Yeah. We do the podcast and you do the little recap and it's all works out.
Omnichannel.
Yeah, dude. All right. Well, we have our own little media network between the two of us, right?
All right. Sounds good.
All right, man. Well, you have a great rest of your day in Canada, and I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Thank you for listening to the Intelligent Investing Podcast with Eric Schlein. If you'd like to connect with Eric for questions, comments, feedback, ideas, or to inquire about being on the show, please contact Eric at intelligentinvesting@gmail.com. So, in the words of Charlie Munger, I have nothing to add.